Welcome to the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Gross, Ironman champion, PhD in women's history, and founder and CEO of Feisty Media. I started this show because I wanted to cut through the BS of diet culture and fitness culture and actually learn from high-achieving women at the top of their game who have figured out how to feel and perform their best at every stage of life. So I chat with experts, elite athletes, and leaders who have learned to succeed despite the massive gender data gap in exercise and medical science and product development. Every episode is filled with information, advice, and anecdotes that will help you fulfill your potential as an athlete, mom, leader, or business owner. And listen up. If you don't subscribe to our Women's Performance newsletter, you are definitely missing out. It's totally free. So head over to womensperformance.com and subscribe now. That's womensperformance.com. This podcast is a production of Feisty Media. Hello, Feisty friends. Sarah Gross here. Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of the Women's Performance Podcast. For the next 4 weeks, you are in for a treat. I am extremely happy to present a four-part mini-series all about how our female hormones affect our performances in sport and life. The series is called Hormonal. And I love that name because who among us has not been talked down to and disregarded with the use of that word? Oh, just ignore Sarah. She's hormonal. Or you know how women get sometimes. They are so hormonal. At Feisty, we are all about reclaiming language, turning it on its head and saying, yeah, we are hormonal and it's amazing. And we are going to harness those hormones to get the best out of our bodies. The mini-series is hosted by two women who are truly subject experts. First, double board certified obstetrician and reproductive endocrinologist Dr. Carla DiGirolamo, who has been featured in Boston Magazine as one of Boston's best doctors every year since 2019. Carla is joined by Feisty's own Celine Yeager, who has been hosting the Hit Play, Not Pause podcast since 2020 and has conducted over 160 interviews with leading experts and top athletes in the perimenopause and menopause space. Combined with her background as a health and science journalist, Celine is great at reading the research and translating it into actionable steps for active women. During these four episodes, over the next 4 weeks, you will learn everything you need to know to work with your body and perform. Episode 1 covers all the basics about your hormones, whether you really need to sync your training routine with your menstrual cycle, how to know when and why you might need hormone testing, and what happens when your hormones start fluctuating in your 40s or flatten out in your 50s and beyond. In episode 2, Celine and Carla cover hormonal contraceptives. We all want to know about birth control, don't we? And how it affects our training. They cover pregnancy and fertility as they relate to our physical activity. And in episode 3, the two discuss common hormonal problems like PCOS and endometriosis. And if all of your questions are not answered after those three episodes, you can ask. So episode 4 answers listener questions about hormones. I've seen some of the questions that have already come in and they are so good. If you have a question and it's before the end of April 2024, just head to the show notes, click on the link and ask away. So for everyone who is sick of the narrative that women's hormones are a curse instead of a blessing, we are here for you. And together we will learn how amazing it actually is to be hormonal.
All right, Carla, welcome back for episode 2.
Thank you. It's great to be here once again.
Last week, we talked basic hormones 101, you know, how hormones, what we know anyway about what how hormones affect our performance. And this week, we want to keep that conversation going, but, you know, talk about hormonal contraceptives, because some studies show that like half of all athletes, you know, female athletes are taking some sort of hormonal contraceptive. They're not naturally cycling women. I think it's super important to talk about that. Talk about fertility and pregnancy and all these things that, you know, really hormonally impact a woman's life. So I'm really glad that you're here. Before we start this conversation, I want to make sure that I get this message out to our listeners that, you know, we know that you're going to have a lot of questions while you're listening to these. And so we have put together a voicemail message box, and you can go to speakpipe.com/hormonal. That will be in the show notes, and you can leave us a voicemail question, and we will do a separate episode at the end answering all your questions. So with that, let's talk oral contraceptives. And I think, Carla, we should start with the basics, because I will tell you that I wasn't that much younger than I am now when I learned that when I was taking the pill way back when, in my early 20s, that I was not actually getting a quote unquote period, that it was just this other kind of withdrawal bleed. Like, it's a I'm like, why didn't I ever know that? Why didn't people tell me that? So let's give the basics. Like, what are hormonal contraceptives? How do they work? And how do they impact that normal menstrual cycle?
Okay. So it is a confusing topic, and it gets more confusing as the next generation of oral contraceptive pills comes out, because what's happened is that the doses of the estrogen component have gotten lower and lower and lower, and that impacts physiology a little bit differently. So we'll start with just the premise behind why early contraceptives work and what their mechanism is. So in an oral contraceptive pill, you have an estrogen component and a progestin component. And these are not bioidentical hormones like you might get with menopausal hormone therapy. These are synthetic derivatives that look like your bioidentical hormones. So we typically have ethinyl estradiol as the estrogen component. And there are a huge variety of progestins out there. And progestins are just derivatives of the natural hormone progesterone. So that's those are the basic components of a contraceptive pill. And so the way they work is that estradiol component suppresses a hormone called follicle stimulating hormone. That is the hormone in the pituitary gland that shouts out to the ovary, hey, it's time to make an egg. And so at the beginning of the menstrual cycle, when one is not on oral contraceptive pills, the FSH hormone elevates, and that hormone is telling the ovary to make an egg. So what the oral contraceptive pill does is that estrogen component suppresses, it puts a muzzle on the pituitary gland, because we don't want it to tell the ovary to make an egg. We don't want to make an egg because we don't want to get pregnant.
Of course.
So think about it as the muzzle for the FSH. And so when you have that constant estrogen component, you know, you're taking 21 days of active pills, the pituitary gland is muzzled. And this is why they tell you, don't forget to take your pills. Because if you forget to take two or three of those pills, the FSH is, you know, it's screaming through the muzzle. All it wants to do is tell the ovary to make an egg. And it's like breaking out of the muzzle, and it gets the message out. And then the ovary hears it and says, I got to make an egg. And then the muzzle gets put back on it again when you remember to take your pill. So that's kind of how it works.
I wish you had been my gynecologist.
Yeah, I would have had to make a little cartoon for that. I'll do that in my next talk. So that's the estrogen component, what it does. But there's another way that contraceptive pills work to prevent conception, and that is through the progestin component. So most people don't know, and I really appreciated this in my years as a fertility specialist, is that there is only like an 18-hour window of time where the uterus is receptive to an embryo, to a fertilized egg that's coming down the pike. And what that receptive window depends on is progestin and the timing of when the ovary starts producing progesterone, because that's what happens after ovulation. The egg gets released and then the ovary starts producing progesterone so that the uterus gets ready for implantation. But when you're on the oral contraceptive pill and the estrogen is there, you're not ovulating, and then You've got the progestin component that is keeping the lining thin. So the lining is staying very thin and not receptive to implantation. So even if an egg does eke out, the lining is too thin and not in a biochemical state where implantation is likely to happen. And this is these two ways that the oral contraceptive pill works are the reason why it's so effective. With appropriate use, meaning you're compliant with it, you take it every day, it's got a 99.5% success rate or efficacy rate. So that's basically how they work. Now, as the levels of estradiol, or not estradiol, ethinyl estradiol, have gotten lower. Like, we used to have birth control pills with 50 micrograms. Now we have really ultra low dose ethinyl estradiol pills down in the 20s. And I think there's even some 10s or 15s out there. In those, ovulation does happen from time to time. So it isn't enough estrogen exposure to suppress and muzzle the pituitary gland, but you still got the same progestins there that are preventing implantation. So we've been able over the generations of contraceptive pills to lower that estrogen exposure, because the side effects that come with that, that people sometimes experience, and still have an effective contraceptive because of the progestin component.
So then why do I need a placebo pill?
Because you need to withdraw the hormones so that the lining sheds. So if you think about the natural menstrual cycle, right? After the egg ovulates, the ovary is producing progesterone. And the reason it's producing progesterone is because that's what's required to support the pregnancy. When there's no pregnancy that lands in the lining, the ovary is looking for that pregnancy hormone signal. When it doesn't get it, it just stops producing progesterone. And as progesterone levels fall, that's when bleeding happens. So that's why when you have the sugar pills, which don't have any estrogen or progestin in it, it effectively mimics the decline and normalization of progesterone down to undetectable levels. And then that's what sheds the lining. And it's healthy to shed the lining.
Even though it's like already low, like you said, that part of the, okay. So, and is that why that there have been some pills that are like, you don't need to do this every month, but maybe every 4 months, you know, I mean, there was, okay.
Yeah. And that has pros and cons to it. Like people who have menstrual migraines, this is probably the reason why they first created these, you know, 3 month active pill type of pill packs, is because every time, you know, one would have a period or one would have a bleed, whether it be a natural cycle or whether it's off of birth control pills, they get these horrid headaches. But if you just keep the hormones continuous for 3 months, then, well, and you only withdraw them every 3 months, they only get 4 really bad headaches a year instead of 12. So, you know, that's kind of how that works. But some of the downsides to doing the continuous is that a lot of people experience breakthrough bleeding, which is very unpredictable bleeding, because, you know, a lot of times, if you go an extended period of time, the uterus kind of doesn't know what to do with that. And it's like, well, I'll just shed a little bit. I'm not quite sure what I'm doing here. I'm just going to shed some lining just for the hell of it. And that unpredictable bleeding can be very bothersome. It's not usually heavy bleeding, but it's still spotting. It's still annoying for people, like if they're on vacation or on their honeymoon, God forbid. So that's the downside. But yes, people use continuous OCPs all the time.
So then there are also just progestin.
Yes.
Hormonal contraceptives, right? I mean, pills too, or just IUDs?
So there is a pill. It's back in the day, it was called the mini pill.
Okay, I remember that. Pill.
Yeah, it's not very effective contraception, but it was given mostly for women who are postpartum and breastfeeding, because the synthetic estrogens, if you were to give like an estrogen progesterone birth control pill to a woman who's lactating, it's going to dry up her milk supply. But you can give her some level of contraception. It's like I said, it's not as good as if you use the combined birth control pills, but you give her some level of protection when she's breastfeeding without drying up her milk supply. So that was what the mini pill was most commonly used for. We still use it today in people who can't take the estrogen component of birth control pills. Like, you know, there's, I think Nexplanon is a progestin-only implant. Of course, you have the IUD, but that works by a different mechanism. You've got Depo-Provera. That is a progestin shot that you take that stays in your system for about a month. And those are mostly for people who maybe can't take estrogen or they prefer not to for whatever reason.
And then how does the IUD work? Because there's both a hormonal and non-hormonal, correct? Copper and
Yes.
yeah.
Yes, that's right. The copper and the various progestin ones. There are, I think, four that are FDA approved. The Mirena is the largest one. It's the physically largest one. This is ideal for women who have carried a pregnancy to, to at least the third trimester. And it has levonorgestrel, which is a type of progestin. And what it does is it acts locally on the endometrial lining. It thins out the lining. Now, it's the highest dose IUD. I think the Lyletta, it's a smaller one, but it also, I think, is 50, but 52, or I'd have to go back and double check, but it's the highest dose. It thins the lining so that implantation can't happen. Plus, there's a foreign body in the uterus, which gets in the way of implantation. Now, these higher dose progestins, they do have some systemic absorption into the bloodstream for a little bit, so it can hamper ovulation for a period of time. But the IUD is good for 5 to 7 years, and so with, in a matter of months, that circulating progestin wanes and becomes undetectable, and then ovulatory cycles come back. The lower dose levonorgestrel IUDs, like the Skyla, the Kylena, those are smaller, and those are ideal for people who have not had a pregnancy in their uterus before, and they are better tolerated. Those are the progestin IUDs. The copper IUD, copper is kind of a very irritating thing to have in the uterus. And so that was actually the first IUD that came out. And so what it does is it creates a local inflammatory reaction in the uterine lining to prevent implantation from happening. You still get regular bleeds and you still ovulate and you get ovulatory bleeding cycles or periods. They can be heavier, they can be uncomfortable, but it is a very effective contraception. And it was even used as an effective emergency contraception. This was before Plan B came out. Someone would, have an unexpected encounter. They're afraid they're going to get pregnant. They go to their doctor. Like, you can really get into your doctor, immediately like that. But back in the day, you could. And they would just put in an IUD, and that was your emergency
Ooh,
contraception.
that sounds rough. That sounds a little rough to me.
Yeah, that isn't done anymore, but probably 2 or 3 decades ago, that was an indication for it. So those are the IUDs. And typically the IUDs over the long term don't interfere with ovulatory cycles. And that's one thing I personally like about them, and why, if we go back to performance, which I know we're going to get into a little bit here, that may be a more favorable, it may be a more favorable situation. It really is, very dependent on the circumstances.
Excellent.
Endurance sports should be accessible to everyone, right? That's why we are so excited to be partnering with Motiv. Motiv is one of the fastest growing training apps in the world today, with thousands of amateur athletes signing up every month and a nearly perfect 4.9 star rating in the App Store. You are not a template, and your training plan should not be either. Prepare for running races, triathlons, cycling events, duathlons, or swim runs, however your season schedule shapes up, and get training written by some of the best coaches in the world in each discipline who know what it takes to help amateur athletes reach their goal on race day. The app takes the training written by those experts and then creates the most optimal training plan for your schedule, abilities, and goals. Plus, the training is fully customized to your race schedule. How much you can train each week, your current abilities, and the goals you want to achieve in your race. You can use the app for free as long as you want, or get all the upgraded features from the app for just $19.99 a month. But as a Feisty listener, you can sign up at mymotiv.com and use the code FEISTY for 2 months of full premium access. That's right, you get 2 months of premium for free. So you quite literally have nothing to lose. So head over to mymotiv.com, mymotiv.com, and use the code FEISTY, FEISTY. And on a personal note, I know the founder of Motiv, and he is driven to make triathlon and all endurance sports more accessible for the athletes who care about their performance, but who aren't quite ready for a full-time personal coach. If that sounds like you, definitely try the app for 2 months for free. You literally have nothing to lose. As a lifelong runner and triathlete turned CrossFitter, I am stoked to announce that the athletic eyewear brand Tifosi Optics has joined us as a partner here at Feisty Media. Tifosi sports glasses hit all the marks for athletes. They're shatterproof polybicarbonate, so the lenses not only reduce glare, but also offer scratch resistance, which I 100% need. They stay in place when you are moving. The hydrophilic rubber nose pads actually get more grippy the more you sweat, so they are secure and don't slide down your face even when you're running in hot conditions. No matter what sport you do, Tifosi has shades for you. Whether you love tennis, fishing, pickleball, running, cycling, or just hanging out on the beach. They are super reasonably priced, which I love, so I can have multiple pairs that go with any outfit. And of course, Feisty listeners get a special discount. So head on over to tifosioptics.com and use the code FM20. FM as in Feisty Media to get 20% off your order. That's FM20 at tifosioptics.com. I'll put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you. For decades, running shoes have been researched, tested, and designed for men. Brands have relied on the shrink it and pink it approach to sell male shoes to female customers. That's why we are so excited to be working with Hedas. Hedas designs athletic footwear for women that elevates performance, safety, and style. Hedas unlocks the science behind women's biomechanics through dedicated research, creates better shoes for women that support their longevity and performance, and establishes new design standards to promote transparency in a male-biased industry. Hedas have a lower ankle collar to reduce rubbing, a breathable mesh toe box to allow for ventilation and to allow for female toe shape, a special kind of plate in the midsole to keep tired legs going, a narrow heel cup to reduce heel slippage and take the pressure off our Achilles, and a rounded instep to create a snug fit. Hedas has 3 shoe models designed for different sessions: the Alma Cruise for long runs, the Alma Tempo for training days, and the Alma Speed for pushing the pace. I've personally been running in the Alma Cruise and I love them. It's the shoe I always wanted and never knew I needed. The fit is perfect in every way. You can get your own pair of Hedas at hedas.com and use the code FEISTY20 for 20% off. That's FEISTY20 at hedas.com and it will all be in the show notes.
All right. Segueing right into it, let's talk performance. And I shared with you, and I'll put them in the show notes, I shared a number of studies, you know, that I've gathered and some articles on it. And, you know, it like the period itself, it seems like, as always, more research needs to be done. But what are we seeing when it comes to performance, particularly when we're talking about the oral contraceptives? Because that's what I see the most being studied, though maybe there's some IUD studies that I haven't seen, or maybe they're all lumped together in some of this research.
It's all over the map. I think there are some trends, but nothing definitive, where performance may not be as robust as it could be off of birth control pills. But for as many studies that say that is the case, there are studies that say it make no difference. I think, you know, like training with your menstrual cycles, we have the same problem with high variability in women's cycles, how they experience those cycles, not just the interval and the number of days you bleed or when you ovulate, but the actual experience of your menstrual cycle. How heavy are those bleeds? How crampy are your bleeds? What kind of PMS do you get? Do you get any at all? Do you feel like crap those first few days of bleeding? Are you lightheaded because you're bleeding so heavily? So just like cycles themselves are variable woman to woman, her experience is variable, a woman to woman, and even cycle to cycle. And that makes it very, very difficult to study in a way that you can actually achieve statistical significance in a finding. So, yes, more study needs to be done, but I think we also need to be realistic that the nice, clean, placebo-controlled, randomized controlled trial that gives you a clean answer is probably not going to happen.
It's not coming. Yeah, that was kind
I
of
don't
my,
think it's coming.
That was my, my take home too. I was curious, when I was reading, there was the I think it was 2020 meta-analysis that sort of put it all together that said might result in slightly inferior exercise performance on average, but like you're saying, there's individuality. So this is just a conclusion of lots and lots of studies, just to sort of find this very small finding that there could be some slightly inferior performance. And then I was like, why? And I found some of those older articles that I shared with you, a couple were a little newer in the past 10 years, about the influence on testosterone. And I was like, is that the link here between, what is that doing? What are these, combined oral contraceptives doing to our testosterone, our free testosterone?
So it's a great question. And yes, it could be some, a lead to follow. That's okay. About where I would put it. The reason why this is being looked at is because oral contraceptive pills and the NuvaRing, as a matter of fact, I did some research on this last night.
I loved the NuvaRing.
Yeah, the NuvaRing is a great product. Still used by many people today.
Yeah.
It increases a protein that's made by the liver called sex hormone binding globulin. So hormones in circulation are often carried by proteins to various tissues and they bind them up. And a lot of times bound hormone is not as active as free hormone, because if it's bound, it really can't connect with the tissue and get internalized by the cell and do its thing. It's bound up. It's just kind of there. And its effects aren't quite as potent as sometimes the free form. And that's the way testosterone works. So this is why the pill is often used to cure acne, because acne can be like an imbalance of, too many male hormones and you get acne. And so when people take birth control pills, what that sex hormone binding globulin does is it mops up all that extra free testosterone that's getting into your hair follicles and causing all those problems. And it clears up your face because it's reducing that impact of that free testosterone. So and that's the other reason why libido is often affected on birth control pills. I know a lot of people who take them, they say, my libido is in the toilet. I don't like this. And it's because A, they're not ovulating, so they don't get the LH surge that then spikes their testosterone. And again, it's also mopping up the free testosterone, which is a component that contributes to our libido. There is a real effect on free testosterone. The big question, though, is whether that translates into A, inability or reduced ability to build muscle mass. I don't think anybody has shown that that is the case, but it's a possibility. It's a theory. And the other is, does it affect performance? That specific issue with the testosterone. Has anyone made a definitive link between that lower free testosterone and exercise performance? That's where the struggle is with the research. And then layered upon top of that, even if we say, okay, maybe it does, impact your training performance, but there's training. And then there's race day,
right.
Just like training with your menstrual cycle. Sure, maybe in your luteal phase, you should be doing more, low intensity, longer duration type stuff. But if the Boston Marathon falls in your luteal phase, is it going to affect your timing much? Don't know, maybe, probably not, competitive athletes, they are running on so much adrenaline. I mean, the body is designed to do that. You know, when the threat is put in front of you, that fight or flight response is going to perform no matter what. So, you know, does the pill have impact on training? Might have impact on training, but whether it actually has an impact on race day, I think that really, really still is, jury is out on that.
Yeah, no, that excellent, excellent explanation. Thank you for that. I did find one study, and I'd have to pull it up again, that there was a diminished lean mass gain that may be related to the effect of oral contraceptives on anabolic and catabolic hormone levels and
Androgenicity.
androgenicity. Thanks. It's a progestin. But really, I just found that one study.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think it's worth looking at. You know, every study that comes out, it doesn't have to be the perfect randomized controlled placebo double blind, you know, massive trial. It doesn't have to be that to be valuable, because sometimes these smaller studies will find something that makes us raise an eyebrow and say, hey, you know, that's a really interesting question. And then additional studies can piggyback on top of that. So, you know, any research that's done and that's done well is worth doing, because I think it does raise questions and gives us things to investigate. But I think at the end of the day, we have to know that research is always going to have limitations. And so what we need to really treat this as, it's a tool. And it's individual, you know, training with your menstrual cycles. We don't know if that as a population increases or improves performance. We don't know that, but it's a tool that we have because on an individual level, it might make a difference. Whereas with birth control pills, it may or it may not. You know, if you have a woman who has horrible, horrible, crampy, heavy periods and her birth control pill helps that, and she feels dynamite and she's not anemic anymore. Well, I would say for that individual, her performance is going to be better on the pill than it would be when she's off of it, because when she's off of it, her periods are hellish. So it really needs to be individualized, and we have to look at these things as individual tools and factors that are just part of a larger equation.
100%. And you know, that is sort of what I was finding in the survey data I was looking for too, that like I said at the start of this, about half of elite female athletes are on some sort of hormonal contraceptive. And it's not, I mean, sure, pregnancy also disrupts performance. So there is, you know, a lot of them are using it contraceptively, but a lot of them, you know, not an insignificant percent said they liked, you know, the ability to reduce the number of bleeds, or they liked the regularity of it. And just sort of, you know, there's something to be said for that and taking the stress off of like, when is my period going to show up? Is it going to show up while I'm at Kona? Do I know? You know, I mean, like all of that is mental energy, right? And when you're talking about training and performance, the less variables that are out of your control, sometimes that makes a big difference.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it really helps the mental game for all the reasons you just said. And the mental game is so key when you're an athlete that competes at that level. So anything you can do to help ease the mind and put it in the right headspace is an absolute win. And that's why it's such a complicated issue. You know, if I have someone that and I see people like this, they, you know, when they're off birth control, their periods are fine. They're regular, they come, they don't have terrible PMS, they maybe need to take Advil for a day, but whatever, it's fine. When people ask me, okay, I'm fine off the pill, do you think my performance is going to suffer if I go on it? I say, you know, I'm not sure. You can track it, you can try it, because you can go on and off the pill and you know, without a problem. You can do that these days. So I usually have people test it out, you know, pick certain metrics that are important for them. You know, if they're a runner, okay, maybe, you know, a good measuring stick is their 5K time or whatever it is. But have a measuring stick. Test it out for 3 months and just see. I do like the IUD. You know, I do like the natural menstrual cycle and all of the things that nature has programmed into us to help us perform physically. You know, my default is always goes back to nature, because Mother Nature knew what she was doing when she designed us, you know, as difficult as nature can be. But, you know, when things are going haywire, that's a different story. You know, you can't suffer through it and you have to kind of take control. But if you're not suffering through it, you know, if you can maintain and leave that in place, it could be ideal. And the IUD is a very effective form of contraception. So then you don't have to worry about, you know, about getting pregnant when you don't want to.
I was thinking too that, you know, we talked a lot about LEA and Red S last week. And if you are taking a contraceptive that is taking away that indicator, that those things are also harder to spot.
For sure. For sure. I think, you know, what we've learned at the Female Athlete Conference in Boston back in June, I think one of the things, big takeaways from that, those talks were that the menstrual cycle is probably the greatest correlate with low energy availability. You know, when you're in LEA for a prolonged and maladaptive sort of period of time, then, you know, your menstrual cycles are going to change. But I think what also came out of that, as well as the IOC consensus statement on LEA and Red S that came out this year, is that there is a great tool that they have published and updated that has lots of different criteria in addition to the menstrual cycle to try to identify somebody who's an LEA or Red S. The CAT3, I think it's a CAT3 tool.
I can put it in the show notes.
Yeah, put it in the show notes. I think everybody should like have this by their desk side because it's really important. But it goes through lots of different metrics that one can use to identify LEA and Red S when the menstrual cycle might not be available.
Excellent.
Building muscle can be tough and gains can be so slow, even for those of us who do a lot of strength training. As an ex-endurance athlete who is now in perimenopause, I know this all too well. It can be frustrating to put in the time in the gym and not see the results I'm looking for. That's why it's super important to take the right supplements at the right time. One of those supplements is essential amino acids, which are needed to trigger muscle protein synthesis. Muscle protein synthesis happens when you eat high quality protein, like eggs or whey. And by supplementing with additional essential amino acids, you can make sure you are getting the full benefit of your training sessions. Targeted essential amino acid formulas can be up to 4 times more effective than just eating protein. I've been taking amino acids for almost a year, and in combination with eating quality protein and a couple other supplements, I have managed to turn the tides on age-related muscle loss, which starts at 30 for women, by the way, and I have continued to make strength gains as I head towards 50. AminoCo has been a longtime sponsor of Feisty Media and has supported all of our brands and podcasts over the years. I recommend starting with AminoCo Perform, and you can grab some at aminoco.com/performance. If you enter the code PERFORMANCE, you will save 30% and receive a free gift if it is your first purchase. Give it a try and let me know how it goes. That's aminoco.com/performance and use the code PERFORMANCE to save 30%. As we head into summer, rest and recovery are critical for improving sports performance, reducing stress, and living a long and healthy life. We should all invest in better sleep. So, think about the thing you lay your head on for 8 hours a night. If it's not exactly right for you, it can lead to needless tossing and turning, or worse, have you waking up with an unrelenting kink in your neck. My new Lagoon pillow has helped me improve my sleep immensely by pairing me with the performance pillow that has everything I need. So I personally was matched with the Otter pillow, shout out to Team Otter, which I love because it has a gentle cooling effect. And I was able to choose how much stuffing I wanted in it, which is super important to me because I'm doing a decent amount of CrossFit these days and my shoulders are kind of creaky. So having a pillow that is stuffed just to the right height keeps my neck and head in exactly the right position and comfortable for the entire night. And as of fall 2023, Lagoon launched their 100% mulberry silk pillowcases. It's cool to the touch, buttery soft, and great for your skin and hair. You've got to go check out this pillowcase if you want to feel great and look great every morning. Waking up for morning workouts has never felt better. I'm refreshed and pain-free thanks to my Lagoon pillow. To check it out for yourself, go to lagoonsleep.com/performance and take the 2-minute sleep quiz to find your perfect pillow match. and then use the code PERFORMANCE for 15% off your first purchase. That's code PERFORMANCE at lagoonsleep.com/performance, whole 15% off, and the link is in the show notes. You can just click through there.
So let's move from trying not to get pregnant to trying to get pregnant, which is your personal specialty. But, you know, I have raced and trained with teammates whose doctors have told them they should stop training and racing if they want to get pregnant. And I will share with you one in particular who was having trouble. When she went back to training and racing, she got pregnant. And that's what I was like, what have we learned? I don't know. So what, you know, I feel like there's a lot of urban legend and mythology around all this. So maybe just set it out for us as far as like a naturally cycling woman who wants to get pregnant. Does she need to stop what she's doing?
No.
Okay, thank you.
It's a flat no. I've been a fertility specialist for 18 years, and there has not been any single issue that has frustrated me more than this one. And I can tell you it's all culturally rooted. It is not rooted in data. It is rooted in some urban legend somewhere down the line. I actually was asked by my practice, Boston IVF, to write the exercise guidelines for the practice. And I did that. I did a grand rounds on it and told everybody, look, you know, the data does not substantiate telling people to stop working out. But what people have to do is they have to go with what they're accustomed to. If you have a marathon runner who wants to go out and, you know, warm up with a 5K, that's fine for her. She can do a zone 2 5K and feel really good. Am I going to tell my sedentary, morbidly obese patient who's never run before to go out and do a 5K? No. So what they do is they try to paint the entire population of people trying to get pregnant with one broad brush stroke and says, nobody should do any of this. Just, you know, sit around, keep your feet up, you know, focus on implantation, drive yourself crazy and suck it up and deal with it. And it's just wrong. And I have so many of my athlete patients who are like, you know, I just today, my acupuncturist said, I really should stop HIIT training. I'm like, why? Well, she said, just because of blah, 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 blah. And it's like, okay, that's just rooted nowhere in data or even logic for that matter. So there's just a lot of misconceptions and lack of knowledge about how the female body is made to move. I mean, nature programmed into us the most incredible ability to physically adapt, and pregnancy is evidence of that. So we are wired for physical adaptation and physical expenditure. And I don't understand why people try to squash that. And I think it's just this cultural sense that, you know, women are fragile. This is why women weren't allowed to run in marathons, because somehow they were going to hurt themselves. You know, thank God for Title IX. And it still persists today. And especially when you're dealing with a very sensitive topic of getting pregnant, you know, it's like, oh, you should do this and you should do that. And it's like, you don't know what you're talking about. But yeah, it's a cultural, huge battle that I fight all the time. And I am constantly sending my exercise guidelines and the data that backs it up to my nursing team, and none of them read it. And they just tell the patients what they want. Seriously. My nurses don't do that. My nurses know better. But cross-covering ones tend to just tell them what they want, you know, and it's frustrating, very frustrating.
When in history did we have the luxury of women just sitting around with their feet up and not like working fields, gathering, taking care? I mean, it doesn't right? even make sense when you look at it that way. I mean,
no,
people have had to labor literally like always yeah. Just to survive. And we're all here, man. We've populated the planet without people putting their feet up and not walking miles for water and God knows what else.
Yeah. I mean, we populated the planet while working out in the fields and squatting and delivering your
what
baby
I mean.
In the fields. I mean, you know, that's what's happened. But yeah, it's this really in different cultures, have a different emphasis on it. There are some Asian cultures that really take a hard line on this. And not only should she not be active, she should be on bed rest every day. And there is a lot of work I have had to do in people of certain cultures to convince them and to show them that, no, that's actually detrimental. If you're on bed rest, you're going to get a blood clot when you're pregnant or when you're, you know, on all these hormones. So you really should get out there and be active. And, you know, movement fuels the body. It's good for us. We're made for it. You know, taking it away only does harm.
Yeah, almost always.
Now, what I will say is that sometimes when people are struggling to get pregnant, if they are in low energy availability or red S, this is going to be problematic for getting pregnant. But the solution is still not stop exercising. The solution is we need to bring your energy back in balance. Usually it's a fueling problem. It's not necessarily a training problem. But you need experts in the industry who are going to help that athlete do that. And physicians are nowhere near equipped to even address that problem. They just don't have the training nor the desire nor the, you know, they're lucky they even know to ask the right questions. So, yeah, I mean, those are situations where, yes, we need to address the energy balance, but not by painting it with a broad stroke saying, oh, just stop exercising, because, you know, that's just not the root of the problem.
Yeah. And a lot of them aren't at those sessions that we are at, like where it's so clearly elucidated that overtraining is almost never that. It's almost always under fueling. Right. And that is kind of the root of all of that. So that segues pretty well into sort of the final part of this particular episode is the person who is legit, like, well-fueled, active, healthy, having problems getting pregnant. So they come to you and now they want to undergo fertility. Now, what are the special considerations there?
So it depends on the treatment. We have lots of different kinds of treatment. We've got oral medications that, you know, help you ovulate maybe a couple of eggs at a time. And then we have IVF. IVF requires hormonal stimulation using injectable hormones that are more potent than the oral ones. And the goal of IVF is to stimulate the ovaries to develop multiple eggs, maybe 10, 15, 20 eggs at a time. And in order to do that, the ovary needs to enlarge. And anyone in the audience who's gone through IVF knows exactly what this feels like. You kind of feel pregnant because the ovaries get large, feel very, very bloated. And so what happens when the ovary enlarges, sometimes if it enlarges asymmetrically, it can predispose the ovary to twisting on itself. And that is something called ovarian torsion. You don't see it that often. I think in my career, maybe somewhere between 5 and 10 times have I seen it happen in the last 18 years, but it's a surgical emergency because if the ovary twists on itself, it cuts off its own blood supply and it could kill the ovary. And many times we have to remove the ovary if an ovary has twisted and stayed twisted for a prolonged period of time. So that is something that can happen if during IVF, when that ovary is enlarged, if someone is running, jumping, turning upside down, that can be problematic when you are in the middle of an IVF stimulation. So that is the restriction that I tell my patients who are training during IVF is that, look, I don't want you running. You can get on the bike, you know, because you're not, you know, bouncing up and down on the bike. You can still train for your marathon, but do your cardio training on the bike. That's a lot safer. My CrossFitters, you know, I can't have them kipping. I can't have them doing box jumps. I can't have them doing handstand pushups and getting, you know, upside down on their head, you know, but you can lift weights. You can do some Olympic lifting. You can do some cleans, some squats, some deadlifts. That's not a problem. Just no running, jumping, or turning upside down. And those are really the only restrictions I give them. I just tell them, you know, do, you know, just avoid those things and you should stay safe and you can still be active, you know, if you feel up to it. And if you don't feel up to it, that's okay too. You're revved up on all these hormones. You know, you could be having some mood issues or mood swings and, you know, maybe you just don't feel like it and that's okay too. So, you know, we want to give people options, giving people choice. That's really, you know, the name of the game and not just painting everybody with a broad stroke and taking all their choice away.
Yeah. So I am hearing, though, that if you're running, you should not be running.
During your IVF stimulation, say you're taking some Clomid, right? That's a pill. It's a relatively mild fertility ovarian induction. I don't tell people to stop running when they're taking Clomid.
Okay.
The ovaries aren't enlarging to the same extent. You know, with Clomid, you're producing maybe 2 or 3 eggs at the most. With IVF, you're producing 15 or 20. So that's a much bigger load on the ovary than Clomid. So, you know, I don't really limit people when they're just getting medication with maybe inseminations or timed relation cycles. But for IVF, I do, because the ovaries really bring in their A game during that stimulation.
And how long are they on their A game?
About 2 weeks. And then about a week after retrieval, I tell people, in retrieval, what that is we pass it, once we develop the eggs, we pass a needle through the vaginal wall into the ovary, and that's how we harvest the eggs. So we're poking the ovary with a needle a number of times to get those eggs out, and we do it on both sides. That does cause bleeding within the ovary, and that bleeding kind of stops itself. So those ovaries are fragile for about a week after the egg retrieval. So during the 2 weeks of stem leading up to the egg retrieval and the week after is when I tell people no running, jumping, or turning upside down. And then after that, they can ease back into it and just see how their body feels, and then they'll be back to normal shortly.
So we have a little bit of time, and I think it would be useful to just talk about pregnancy for just a little bit. I mean, pregnancy is obviously a very individual process, and you should always work with your doctor. But things have certainly changed since the days when I had my daughter and they told me, don't get your heart rate above 140. And I said, I'm not listening to you, you know, and they were fine with me. But, you know, where are we now with the guidelines as far as exercise and pregnancy?
Well, there's guidelines, and then there's what is evolving in the fitness space as what is safe and what is okay to do. You know, I think we have to keep in mind, and this is a limitation of the OBGYNs out there, is that this is a very litigious field. And I think a lot of the recommendations that come are, you know, out of that little piece in the back of one's subconscious that's like, all right, I don't want something bad to happen and get sued. I mean, no one wants anything bad to happen to their patients, you know, regardless of whether it's a lawsuit behind it or not. But I think a lot of that fear of women exerting themselves comes from the very litigious environment of obstetrics and gynecology. So that being said, I honestly don't believe that 140 heart rate recommendation is actually out there anymore.
It's
I believe
gone.
It's been defunct.
Yeah.
But the nursing team at Boston IVF are still telling people not to get their heart rate above 140. And I'm probably going to get in trouble for saying this on the air, but hey, bring it. They can call me and I can have a conversation with them. But yeah, they're still being told this. Don't get your heart rate, even though even though it's been debunked, and even though, you know, the recommendations are no longer. I think, and I hope it's okay to plug this person here, because I think she is the single greatest individual with the most knowledge about this, and that is Brianna Battles, Battles. She is a big CrossFitter, and she has done more work than any athlete I know on training during pregnancy. Just search her out on Google, and she has some tremendous resources. I have learned an amazing amount from her and from her material. She's been doing this for a while. She's got a course, and she's really the guru when it comes to training in pregnancy. So there's what the doctors are going to tell you to do, which is, you know, basically take it easy. And you know, they're going to be very vague about it. But there's what you can do. And I think the single best advice that I give my patients is do what you're accustomed to doing. You know, if you're sedentary, I think walking is great. Walking is great for the sedentary individual. If you're a triathlete, then, you know, go do that zone 2 5K. There's no problem with that. You could probably do that into your third trimester. You always just want to be careful not to fall, because falling is bad, you know, second trimester and beyond. And just stay within your lane of fitness, but be mindful of the fact that as the second and third trimester come about, your center of gravity is changing and you do need to be more careful about falling. Now, that doesn't mean you have to stop, you know, because everybody will tell you to stop. You don't have to stop. If you're a tennis player, if you're, you know, if you play whatever, just know, okay, I'm just going to be more aware of my center of gravity and just, you know, adapt. That's what women are great at doing. We're great at adapting physically. And so that's the advice I give people. Stay within your lane of fitness and do what you're used to doing.
And listen to yourself. Your body knows. Like, I felt very, very comfortable on my bike all the way through. Was I riding the same, like, very, you know, black diamondish kind of trails? No, you know, like, I of course not. But I felt really good riding tame trails. I was happy. I wasn't going to fall over. It was all fine. But, you know, I mean, at some point, like, my joints felt kind of loosey-goosey, so I wasn't lifting the same way. You just sort of, like you said, you just adapt to how you're feeling. You're not trying to override any of those sensations.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think the other barrier, too, and, you know, I experienced this when I was pregnant, too. The barrier out there is that, and this is sad, but it's true, is that, you know, a lot of women don't feel well during pregnancy, and they don't feel like working out, and they kind of take the eating for two very, very seriously, and, you know, think their baby needs their own piece of chocolate cake. And, you know, people experience pregnancy the way they want to experience it. And when they see other people who maybe are training and enjoying their training, there is a sense of maybe, well, some insecurity there and some self-doubt. And I think when people experience that during their pregnancy, they can sometimes impose certain things on other people. And so I think there's a lot of shaming that goes on. That's very unfortunate from people that just may not be comfortable with their own decisions and in their own skin.
You become public property when you're pregnant. Like, everybody feels the need to tell you exactly what they think about everything that you're doing. Yeah.
Oh, that's no lie. And I'll tell you, I was pregnant with my son when I was in fellowship. And, you know, I have one child, as you know. And I remember being pregnant and people, you know, it's like, okay, so, you know, you're going to breastfeed your baby. And I'm like, have I met you? And, you know, I'm standing on the T in Boston, the MBTA, the subway system, and someone puts their hands on my belly. I'm like, what are you doing? Don't touch me. I don't know you. You know, you're invading my personal space. And I remember saying to my husband, I'm like, I did 4 years of OBGYN residency at Brown University, and they never taught us about this dynamic that exists when you're pregnant and how everybody thinks that you are their personal property.
It's weird.
It is weird. It is really weird. And so I think people need to be aware of that and navigate it as best they can. But it's there, it's real. And it's really driven by some bizarre things in our culture.
I 100% agree. So before we wrap it up, I did want to make sure that we did address that, because I know you see this in your practice, and it probably doesn't affect a large segment of this audience, but they need to know, if they are doing fertility treatments, there may be a number of banned substances, correct?
Correct. Yeah, most of them. Most of the drugs that you will be on for an IVF cycle are prohibited substances. I did have a professional floor hockey player. She played in Europe, and she was doing IVF with me. And I had to make a list of every single drug that she was on the banned substance list. So that required some legwork on my end to, you know, send this to the gaming committee. I forget what they were called, but I had to send a lot of documentation to them of what she was doing and that she wasn't drug doping to perform in her sport. But yeah, they are. And, you know, fortunately, a lot of these medications for fertility do leave the system very quickly. But still, you know, I mean, you've trained for this event for a long time. You put a lot of heart and soul and blood, sweat and tears into it. You want to make sure that, you know, your I's are dotted and T's are crossed and that you don't, you know, test positive when you think that you're clear. So just get as much information as you can from the people that will be testing you and, you know, go to your fertility doctor and, you know, and they will hopefully be able to help you navigate it.
Excellent. And then finally, I promise, is that a question that has come up a bunch that I did want to ask you and didn't think of earlier is that I have heard people say that being on contraceptive use will harm your future fertility. And can we just make sure that we address that?
Oh, goodness, no, no. You know, and I think where that comes from, and I understand where it comes from. What, because people will be, okay, take the pill for 10 years, and that's fine. The pill was made to be taken for a long period of time. And then they come off the pill and they find out that they're in premature menopause. And they think that the pill caused their menopause. That's not what's happening. What the pill does, though, it doesn't cause these things to happen. It masks them. So you could become menopausal on the pill and not know it because you're getting these artificial bleeds. Back to your original point, we came full circle, that these are not ovulatory bleeds. Right. These are artificial bleeds from the withdrawal of hormones. And so people think they're bleeding. They think they're fine. And then all of a sudden they go off the pill and now they're in menopause. And it's not because the pill caused this to happen. It just had been creating these artificial bleeds that just mask the fact that you lost your ovulatory cycles. So yes, the pill doesn't cause these problems. The pill just masks underlying physiology that's already there.
That makes a lot of sense. And do you need to like wait some sort of prescribed amount of time before you try to get pregnant? That used to be something they would tell you to.
It used to be a thing with the higher dose contraceptive pills, but with these low dose pills, actually the first month that you come off is probably your most fertile month.
Hmm. Good to know.
Yeah. Yeah. So you don't have to wait anymore.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you want to make sure that people understand about any of these topics that we've talked about, from not being pregnant to being pregnant to everything in between?
I think the key, I mean, I think what we can summate from this episode is that mainstream medicine really has limitations in their knowledge about these things. And so it's so important for us in every phase of our reproductive life to do our homework and to find reputable places to get your information. Question what your doctor tells you. If something doesn't seem right, question it. You have every right to do that. And I know the millennial generations and the Gen Zs are so good at questioning. I have a teenager. Oh, my God. But I'm thankful for that, because that's really what needs to happen, because we're trying to also tell our menopausal women, who are the Gen Xers, to question when we were hammered into our heads not to ever question. So you got to question things. You got to do your homework, empower yourself, and know that there's limitations to research. There's limitations to mainstream medicine. And so what we're left with is trying to empower ourselves to fill the gaps.
Great place to leave it. And we will come back next time and talk about some hormonal conditions, you know, PCOS and endometriosis, and some things that can go awry with this nature cycle. So look forward to that. And I thank you as always.
Oh, thank you, Celine. It's a pleasure as always.